All right, we're going to go ahead and get started here. We do have the children's class going on in the back. Yes? Yeah. All right, so I'll try to keep volume down a little bit. If you have trouble hearing me, you're welcome to scoot forward or just ask me to speak louder, and Abby can project past me. She's a school teacher. She knows how to do it. But we'll jump in. We're in the book of Numbers, and we're going to be in chapter 28 in just a moment. Our aim is to get through chapter 31 today, 32 rather, and we'll see how we go. Let's go ahead and start with a prayer. Father, we're so thankful to be here today. Thank you for the energy and the strength to get up and to come together to study your word with other Christians and to worship you. Thank you for preserving this message for us. There are treasures here to be found. We want to hear what you want to tell us. Please give us wisdom. Give us courage. The things that we learn about here today should change us and help us to be more of what you want us to be. Help us to see your purpose for us, to grow close to you, and to appreciate the sacrifices you've made to have your people. Please be with us as we worship you today too. We want to honor you in the ways that you desire, and we want to be an encouragement to each other. We leave here better equipped to serve. It's in the name of Jesus we pray. Amen. All right, so Numbers is a challenging book in some ways because it seems kind of helter-skelter. Like, just there's stories popping up here, there, everywhere. Exodus follows a simple narrative. Leviticus is a lot of law. And then you get to Numbers, it's like, what in the world's going on in Numbers? Remember, the Hebrew title is In the Wilderness. So we're really looking at all of the things that are happening while the people are traveling on their way to the Promised Land. And in 1 through 10, remember that they're still at Sinai. Really what they're doing is they're waiting for about 1 month because there was a group of people who couldn't take the Passover memorial. And so each year, the first month, anybody remember what day Passover is on? Amos? It's the first month, and it's the 14th day. Did you say it? Yeah, 14th day. The twilight of the 14th day. So that makes the Feast of Unleavened Bread the 15th day. And so you're going into this month where you're remembering your identity as God's people, but there's a group of people who couldn't take it because they were unclean. And so all of these things in 1 through 10 are really taking place in that month while they're waiting for these people to have the second opportunity. You could take it in the second month if you missed it in the first month. So the people are offering sacrifices, and they finally leave. And what marks them leaving is the pillar of cloud, pillar of fire. Remember, it lifts up and moves on. The angel of the Lord goes before them, and they go into the Promised Land. The traveling periods is where all the bad stuff happens. Like, that's where people complain. You know, why'd you bring us out here to die? There's no water. There's no food. And so you see a lot of that happening in 10 through 12. And then they finally get to the wilderness of Paran, and they send 12 spies. And now this was their idea. We'll read in Deuteronomy later in our studies. It was their idea to send spies into the land. But God said, yeah, go ahead and send them in. 10 come back with a poor report. Great land, but we can't possibly enter in. And the two guys who brought back the good report? Thank you. Joshua and Caleb. You guys hear me okay? I'm trying to rein it in because I don't want to blast them out back there. So, Joshua and Caleb bring back the good report, and they are eager to go into the land. God will take us in. He'll keep his promise. He's faithful. He's powerful. He's mighty to defend. But the people won't listen. They rebel. They want to kill Joshua and Caleb and Moses and Aaron, appoint a new leader, and go back to Egypt. You can't stay in the wilderness. And so they want to go back to Egypt. God stops them. You know, they end up realizing God's not going to be with us. They say, well, no, we'll go in. We'll go in. God says, no, you're not. The next generation is going in. No, we'll go in. And so they try to go into the land, and they fight. They lose. And so they spend the next 40 years wandering in the wilderness. There's some stories that happen during this period. There's someone who breaks the Sabbath by gathering wood. They take him, ask God, what do we do with this person? The answer was to stone him. They don't just decide, here's what we're going to do. But they determine, we're going to ask God what to do. Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, what happens with these guys? Go ahead.
Rebel against the Levite political system, yes.
Yeah. Dathan and Abiram from the tribe of Reuben, Korah from the tribe of Levi. And aren't all God's people holy? So why can't we do holy things too? That wasn't the way God had authorized it. It wasn't the way he had planned things. And so they go to offer incense, and God consumes some of the leaders. The earth opens up, swallows them whole, and then the next day the people are pretty upset, which is just like, that boggles my mind. God just, like, destroyed these people in a miraculous way, and the next day they're upset with Moses. Like, it's Moses' fault. Kind of weird. But then you've got Aaron's rod. God determines to show, like, this is my man. This is the leader that I've appointed, the one I've chosen. And he takes a dead stick and makes it alive. And it bears fruit. And so he's the chosen leader of God's people in this way, the mediator for God's people. Aaron's rod is a fun pointing to the ultimate story. Don't get lost in numbers. Remember, we're looking forward to Jesus. We're looking forward to someone who's going to lead God's people, who was dead and is now alive, and who is the perfect mediator, who is never going to die again. Aaron's going to die by the end of his story, but we need a priest, we need a mediator who's going to provide for God's people. Amos? You have to speak up a little bit, but... Yes, yeah. So we're going to get there in ticker 22. So some more traveling stuff in 2021. Some of that would be the fiery serpents. What happens with fiery serpents? Alex? Yeah, the people are complaining again. And so God says, I want to send this plague. But when the people cry out, he says, you know, make this bronze serpent. And you look at the serpent and you live. Jesus later uses that to talk about himself. Just as they lifted up the bronze serpent, so they'll lift up the Son of Man. Whoever looks to him will live. It resembles the curse, right? So all these stories, kind of keep them in order. You've got these three main sections where they're camping out and the traveling betweens. Finally, we're in the plains of Moab and the people are getting ready to go in. We just took the census back in chapter 26, and we discovered that all of that previous generation had died, and so they're ready to go in. So this is super exciting. You got a new generation of people who have seen God's judgment, they've seen God's deliverance, and this is probably going to be one of the most faithful generations Israel's ever known. It'd be interesting to kind of talk through what might be some runners up, but this is probably going to be one of the most faithful generations. Some of them are going to remember the Red Sea crossing, they're going to remember the plagues. They're going to remember the judgments on their parents in the wilderness. They're going to see crossing over the Jordan River. So this generation is not just seeing these things, but it's determining to follow through and actually conquer the land. That's going to make them faithful. Now, lots of people see miracles and signs in the Bible, but not all of them believe and actually act on it. But this generation is going to, and that's the exciting thing. All right, thoughts or questions before we jump into today's text? All right. So here's what we're looking at in chapter 28 through 29. This may initially seem like kind of a run-through section. Like, why do I need to know this? We'll talk about that as we go through here. So be thinking about, why is this relevant today? We're not under the old law. We're not offering animal sacrifices or drink offerings or grain offerings, that sort of thing. But be thinking about, what do I do with this as someone in the new covenant? How is this information helpful? And if you think of something along the way, you know, please share it, because otherwise this is going to be kind of monotonous, and you'll see just how monotonous it is. But we look at the daily offerings, the new moon offerings, unleavened bread offerings, Feast of First Fruits offerings, we'll talk about that in a second, and then the seventh month, there are lots of sacrifices there. So every day, the Israelites were to offer one male lamb in the morning, and one male lamb in the evening. So two male lambs every day, a year old, without blemish. So when I mention male lambs, as we talk about that through this section, every male lamb is supposed to be 1 year old and without blemish. In fact, as you read through 28 and 29, it's like, make sure it's without blemish. A lamb, when you picture a lamb, what do you picture? Amos? A Okay, yeah, baby lamb getting milk from his mom, right? And I picture like they're bouncing and they're fuzzy and that kind of thing. That's not what this is, right? This is a one-year-old male lamb, meaning he's not old enough to be a ram. He's not out there working with the ewes. He's just a young guy, but he's not little baby, right? That's kind of what I used to picture, but this is not like a newborn male lamb. This is a year-old lamb. This is a big animal, okay? Along with that, and I put two up here with the bread. If you work through the math, this comes out to, I wrote it down, about 2 liters of grain, and then about a quart of oil and a quart of wine. And the wine would actually be poured out in the holy place. I'm not sure where in the holy place. There's some options. If they're tending the lampstand morning and evening, it might make sense that they pour it out near the lampstand morning and evening. But they're also offering incense morning and evening, so it might make sense that they pour it, you know, near the altar of incense. We're not told where. It could just be in the middle or at the entrance. I don't know. That seems like a terrible place to pour it, at the entrance. But you're just pouring it somewhere in the holy place. So that's what's represented here by the drop. That's the oil. And the cup is the drink offering, okay? So these are just icons representing stuff. But that's every day. Now, on the Sabbath day, there's a difference. What's the difference on the Sabbath day? Let's go ahead and read verses 9 through 10. On the Sabbath day, 2 male lambs, a year old without blemish, and 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour for a grain offering mixed with oil. And we saw the measures of oil in the previous verses. And its drink offering. This is the burnt offering of every Sabbath besides the regular burnt offering and its drink offering. So what's going on the Sabbath day? What's the difference? Yeah, it's twice as much, essentially. What we're looking at is 2 in the morning and 2 in the evening. Now, we're not told the reason why. I find this kind of interesting. When you think of the Sabbath day, what do you think of?
Resting.
Yes, a day of rest. But we're adding work to the priests. What's the significance with that? What else is a Sabbath day about? Amos? It's not about passing over, but it's connected to that. There's going to be the Passover sacrifice, but it is connected to what happened at Passover. God's going to tell the Israelites, remember that I delivered you from bondage. So the reason that they're resting is because they're no longer slaves in Egypt. They have a new master who gives them rest on the Sabbath day. And so they're remembering that God brought them out. So there's something about this sacrifice where they're amply blessed in this rest that God has provided. I don't know all the connections there, but that seems to be part of it. So that's the daily offerings, Sabbath offerings. So every day, this is just part of it. Now, this is in addition to, this is kind of like baseline, standard, default sacrifices. But if you have a sin offering or a burnt offering or peace offering, all that is on top of this. So this is just for the congregation. Now, go ahead.
Is this for like Passover time?
No.
This is like
every day.
Every day.
Every day. Every day, morning and evening. So it'd be 2 lambs every day. And if it's Sabbath day, it'd be 4 lambs every day. Yes, Grace.
How many
are doing this? It's like one in the
morning, one in the evening, and that covers the entire congregation. It's not like every person has to do it.
Yes, that's correct. Thank you.
So, like, whose lambs are these? Do they, like, rotate some?
Let me come back to a previous slide. This is the offering that's given from the herd. Say to them. It's not going to say it here, but when we start looking, look at verse 11. At the beginnings of your months, you shall offer a burnt offering to the Lord, 2 bulls from the herd, 1 ram, 7 male lambs. Earlier we saw that all the congregation tithes to the Levites tithe to the priests. And part of what's given there is a herd and a flock for the priests to keep for the congregation. So the congregation is actually going to keep sheep, oxen for this specific purpose. So yeah, but thank you for pointing that out. This is not individual, like I'm not offering two lambs every day. This is for the entire congregation. Good question. All right, other thoughts? Okay, now, for the new moon, you've got more happening. You've got two bulls, one ram, and seven male lambs without what? Without blemish. Again, you've got all that happening here. And then you also have one male goat. He's always throwing on the end. One male goat. These others are burnt offerings. And you've got mainly, I hate to boil it down to this, but remember when we were looking through Leviticus, there are essentially three main types of sacrifices. Now, there are some other sacrifices like consecration offerings or vow offerings, but vow offerings are kind of like thank offerings, which are kind of like peace offerings. So the three main types of sacrifices, you've got sin offering, which removes my sin. Okay, it atones for my sin. It makes me one with God again. It removes anything that's offensive. You have the burnt offering, which with the sin offering, the priest gets part of that. With the peace offering, we'll talk about, that which is just a celebration of my relationship with God. I'm going to eat some of that. With the burnt offering, nobody eats any of that. That's completely devoted to God. And it seems like that's what that symbolizes, is a complete devotion to God. So I need my sin removed, and we need to be devoted to God in the burnt offering, and then I can celebrate this. And the NIV calls it fellowship offering. So peace offering, fellowship offering. So there's three main types of sacrifices. With these sacrifices, they're burnt offerings, and then you have the male goat each month who's going to be offered as a sin offering. In addition to that, you have the appropriate sized offerings of flour mixed with oil, so that your grain and your oil offerings, as well as your drink offerings, all poured out in the tabernacle. Now, all this is on top of the daily offerings. So this doesn't replace the, like, one in the morning, one in the evening. You do that and these on the first day of every month, so that your new moon sacrifices, okay? Good so far? Now, new moon sacrifices, can you think of any stories in the Bible where a new moon sacrifice is kind of an important thing? Or just any teaching in the Bible about new moons? Check this one. Look at Colossians chapter 2. This is New Testament. Think about if you're an Israelite, if you're a Jew, and you're used to this sort of schedule. Every moon, a new moon, every first of the month, they're going to blow a trumpet. This is found in Leviticus, where they're going to blow a trumpet to indicate new moon. So the new month has begun. And you're going to offer these sacrifices. So in Colossians chapter 2, in talking about the passing away, the fulfillment of the law with its demands in verse 14 with Jesus, and Jesus fulfills the law in his body. He completely perfects the law in his sacrifice, and that's nailed to the cross in verse 14. In verse 16, he says, "Therefore, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink, or with regard to a festival, or a new moon, or a Sabbath. These are a shadow of the things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ." So with the Jews, there's going to be this constant reminder every month of, I need to be brought near to God. Look at the cost of it. And this is for the entire congregation. With Jesus, that cost is completely provided for. And so for the Jews, they no longer need this if they come to Christ. If they see Christ as that sacrifice, this is no longer necessary. But as the Jews, you're reminded every month, I need to be cleansed. I need to be devoted to God. I need to be brought into this relationship with Him. So it's this regular reminder of how fragile but how important that relationship is. Right? There's another story, and it, I don't know, you might just read over it, but do you remember when David, King David, he's not king yet, he's been anointed by Samuel, but Saul is really jealous of him, and he's been trying to kill him in various inventive ways for a little while, and in 1 Samuel, this is back in chapter 19, I didn't look it up, it's 1 Samuel 19. First Samuel 20. In 1 Samuel 19, there's like all this like, hey, David, why don't you go kill these Philistines for me? And David's like, sure. And he goes off and kills all the Philistines. He's like, ah, rats, I thought they were going to do him in. Well, why don't you go kill those Philistines? Okay, yeah. And he goes and kills those guys. And Saul's like, this guy keeps winning. Like, I'm trying to send him off from these secret missions. And he's taking his task force with him, and they're winning. Okay, well, turns out my daughter really likes David. So, yeah, David, you can marry my daughter if you kill so many Philistines. And he's, you know, David's like, sure, great. And he goes and kills a bunch of Philistines, and Saul keeps, ah, why won't he just die? And finally, David figures out, Saul's trying to kill me. In fact, he goes to his house one night, sends soldiers to his house, bring David out. This is in chapter 19. And David and Saul's daughter, which is David's wife, Michael, it's like, no, like, he's sick. And so they come back to Saul, like, we totally bring him to you, but he's sick. I don't care, bring him on his bed. And so they back to David's house, and you know, they trick him. There's a statue there, a teraphim, and they bring that back, and Saul's super terribly angry, accuses Michael. Michael kind of throws David under the proverbial bus here. And then in chapter 20, David is run away, and he calls Jonathan after him. And he says, you know, your dad's trying to kill me. Jonathan says, no. If he were trying to kill you, I'd know about it. Like, my dad and me were like this, all right? You know, we're like, I would totally know. And David says, seriously? He's already thrown a spear at me twice. Like, he's trying to kill me. And so he convinces Jonathan to lie to his father, saying, hey, it's a new moon festival, and I would be here to celebrate the new moon with you, but my father invited me to go and celebrate the new moon with him. So the new moon kind of becomes an excuse for David to check and see if Saul's going to be angry with him or not. So some of these like background things, maybe we don't think about, but when you're studying through the law, you go, oh yeah, okay, now I know how that works in the story. Is there to be this offering on behalf of the congregation, and the people might have this celebration with regard to that offering. All right. That was my excuse to tell a bunch of Bible stories all at once. But just, you know, track that along and pack that away. So that's the new moon. Every first of the month, they'd blow the trumpets, celebrate the new moon, and continue forward. Questions, thoughts? All right. Now you've got the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And the Feast of Unleavened Bread is synonymous with what other feast?
Passover.
Passover is day one, and then the Feast of Unleavened Bread is for the full week. So it begins on day 15. Okay, so twilight of the 14th day, the Passover lamb is sacrificed. And then beginning on day 15, which is right at that moment, you've got 7 weeks of unleavened bread. Now what's interesting with this is it's pretty much exactly like what we saw before with the new moon offerings, except that you offer the male goat here, right? But you would, no drink offering is mentioned. Now there are going to be a couple of times where no drink offering is mentioned, and some of this, you know, I'm hunting for it, so if you see something different here, please let me know. But no drink offering for the Feast of Unleavened Bread. We're not told why, but could you think of a reason why there would be no drink offering, Feast of Unleavened Bread? So there is there's part of the memorial with the Passover. With the Passover itself, it was unleavened bread because we're in a hurry to get out of here. But why else? Elijah? There'd be no leavening agents. There's no leaven. Now, again, we're not told that's the reason why, but it's just interesting. There's no drink offering mentioned here, so why would not be part of that? David?
I was thinking about that just a bit. So that kind of makes sense, but then also you have, at least, especially in the New Testament, you see that wine is part of the Feast of the Passover itself.
Yes.
There's nothing that says, hey, cast out your wine from your houses.
Yeah. And I'm assuming there that, and of course that's New Covenant, right? That's not in the instructions in the Old Law. Those are traditions that have come about later. I'm assuming that would be new wine, not fermented wine. But we don't have any wine offered here. And so I don't know. Those are questions I have. And I'll tell you, it's no wonder that they relied on the rabbis to explain some of this. You know, like, what do we do day to day? And this rabbi says this rabbi says this. And Jesus comes along and says with authority, here's the thing. So I have questions about it too. So there'll be a few times here where there's no drink offering mentioned. All right, other thoughts? Now this is just the first of the day, first of the week of unleavened bread. The first day there's going to be a holy convocation. That's what the ESV says in this. If you're looking at Numbers 28 and verse 26 on the day, sixteen. On the 14th day of the first month is the Lord's Passover, and on the 15th day of this month is a feast. 7 days shall unleavened bread be eaten. Verse 18, on the first day there shall be a holy convocation. Other translations may say a sacred assembly or a holy assembly or a sacred convocation, some combination of those words. But the people would get together and do this sacrifice together. And then you'd also have a holy assembly on the seventh day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Right? Now that's going to come into play when you're reading in the Divided Kingdom. Hezekiah gathers all the people together to remember the Passover. No Passover had been celebrated like that in a long time. And so Hezekiah does this with the people, and they actually say, that was really important for us. We got a lot out of that, remembering who we are as a people, that God brought us out of Egypt. We're going to do it again. And actually had 2 weeks of a Feast of Unleavened Bread. Feast of First Fruits. That's what verse 26 says. For 28, verse 26. Same offerings. You got the male goat again. And this time a drink offering is specified. First Fruits is what my translation says. Other translations, or do you have a heading here in verse 26? The Feast of Weeks. Yeah? And so what else is this known as? Feast of First Fruits, Feast of Weeks, and Feast of... Not Booths yet. Pentecost. This is Pentecost. So this is 7 weeks from the Saturday following the Passover. So that 7 weeks plus the one day Saturday, that's 50 days, Pentecost. So this is where Pentecost is coming from, the Feast of Weeks, okay? So these are the sacrifices they would offer then. Again, the two bulls, one ram, the seven male lambs without blemish. Again, the one male goat for the sin offering, the oil and the flour mixed together, and then the drink offerings for each. Now, then you get to the Feast of Trumpets, and this is getting into the seventh month. And chapter 29 is really all about the seventh month. There's a lot that happens in the seventh month. So... this is kind of like, I'm trying to think of some mad rush in our calendar, but like we're probably in it right now. Like Thanksgiving, Christmas time is like, get together with family and do this thing and do that thing, and you're trying to schedule New Year's or whatever. It's just like all the stuff packed in right around one time. For the Jews, it would be the seventh month. The first day of the seventh month, you have the Feast of Trumpets. Now, they blow the trumpets every first day of the month, every new moon. But with this one, it's a day of blowing trumpets. In verse 1, on the first day of the seventh month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall not do any ordinary work. It is a day for you to blow the trumpets. And then it goes through the offerings that would be given then. You've got the bull, one bull this time, one ram, seven male lambs again, the year old without blemish, the grain offerings with each, the oil. And again, no drink offering this time. Not really sure why. In verse 6, it mentions grain offering, drink offering, with the regular burnt offerings. It doesn't seem like that goes with these offerings. For some reason, no drink offering. And we're going to see that pretty consistently through the seventh month. And it may be that the seventh month is meant to be a time of serious reflection, because there's going to be an important feast during the seventh month, or important memorial during the seventh month. And so this is not a celebration, it's more of a serious focus for the people. So the wine is taken out. But I don't know how this day is different than the other first of the month blowing of trumpets, except maybe the whole day is blowing the trumpets. I don't know how they would have done that. There is this, if you look at Psalm 81... And there are some psalms that as you read them, you'd think, maybe this fits with this feast. Maybe this fits with this memorial. And sometimes we're not sure. But in Psalm 81, verse 1, sing aloud to God our strength. Shout for joy to the God of Jacob. Raise a song. Sound the tambourine, the sweet lyre with the harp. Blow the trumpet at the new moon, at the full moon on our feast day. So that connects with some of the things we've seen already. But then he goes on to talk about all the ways that the people would not listen to God. And that's going to fit with the seventh month. In the seventh month, they're to remember that in the wilderness, they didn't listen to God. They need their sins atoned for. Seventh month is all about the wilderness. It's all about remembering that God was patient with them, that he was kind with them. Even as they rebelled, God wanted to bring them out. And what he says here, look at verse 16. Psalm 81, verse 16. But he would feed you with the finest of the wheat, and with honey from the rock, I would satisfy you. Back in verse 7, they're asking for water. Give us water, give us water. And there's Meribah, they tested God, they rebelled against God. And God says, I can give you something better. Not just water I can give you, but I can give you honey from the rock. I don't understand all of this. This is a really neat image. Honey is rare. Honey is valuable. And if you find honey, you treasure that. But God says, I can strike the rock and bring honey for you out of the rock. Now, the land was supposed to be a land flowing with milk and honey. But God says, you don't have to wait till you get into the promised land, Canaan, to get the honey. I've got it for you right here. What in the wilderness was like honey? Literally like, oh, what was the manna? The manna was supposed to be like wafers baked with honey is the way it tasted, right? So Nature's Valley. I don't know what this is going on. But that was the flavor of the stuff. And so God is seeming to connect this picture here of, I can provide these good things for you out of nothing. Like, honey doesn't happen in rocks. Like, water doesn't come from rocks. Bread doesn't fall from the sky. But with God, he can take these nothings and provide for his people not just what they need, but even the delights that they desire. So this month, the Feast of Trumpets, what we're going to see with the Day of Atonement, is really all about remembering that they had rebelled against a God who had done them good, and they need to remember to be faithful to him. All right. I'm throwing a lot at you. Good so far? I can see thoughts. Any thoughts anybody want to share so far? All right, let's keep cranking here then. The Day of Atonement, and this is not the atonement sacrifice. We've already talked about in Leviticus 16 the actual sacrifices for the actual atonement offerings, but this is just an addition to that. So remember, with the atonement sacrifices, you'd have the bull, the ram, and then the two goats. You remember, you'd have one goat that lots were cast for them. One would have the sins confessed over and the sacrifice made, the blood poured out, and the blood would actually go into the most holy place. And the other, the sins would be laid on that goat. And the goat would go off into the wilderness, bearing the iniquity of the people away from God's camp. But with this day, the Day of Atonement, you've got all of the regular burnt offerings in addition to those. The daily offerings, the male goat, and then, again, no wine. This day. It seems to be something that God's wanting them to be sober about, to be thinking about in that time. All right, now, Feast of Booths. This is kind of a fun one. A lot of sacrifices, Feast of Booths. I had to make my bull smaller. there are 8 days for the Feast of Booths, so it lasts just over a week. And on day one, you've got 13 bulls being sacrificed, two rams, and 14 male lambs, and still one male goat. And that's kind of the interesting pattern with all of these, is you've got just like however many bulls, however many rams, however many lambs, one male goat. I want to ask you why, and we're not told why. So I'm just like, we have to think and process, like, why is just one male goat for sin? But day one is 13 bulls. Day two is 12 bulls. And then day three, you're reducing a bull each day. Day four, day five, day six here, you just got 8 bulls, but still just 8 bulls. It's a lot of work. You know, sacrificing one. Has anybody ever done like a whole hog barbecue before? No? You have. It's simple, right? It's short process. It's a lot of work, right? And messy work. So think about all of the work that's going into offering these on one altar. It's a process. And they're doing this, you know, 8 days straight. Okay? Elijah? Okay. Excellent point. Yeah. You know, Grace's question, where did they get these sacrifices? This is part of God providing for the continuing of this relationship with Him. So it's not like they're giving something up to God. They are. But where did they get it in the first place? God's providing for them. He's making them prosper. It's a good point. All right. Again, day 7. Now we're down to 7 bulls. And then finally on day 8... You know, we kind of go back to a regular system. And again, this is all in addition to the one lamb in the morning, one lamb in the evening, 2 in the morning on the Sabbath, and 2 in the evening on the Sabbath. So this is all in addition to that. And then, let's say that Levi has a sin he needs to take care of. And Meredith wants to celebrate her relationship with the Lord. And, you know, and I'm going to be redevoted to the Lord, but I've got some sin I've got to take care of too. Like, we all got to bring our sacrifices individually on top of all of this, right? So, a lot of blood being offered. So the question is, why just one male goat? I find it interesting there's only one. And in 1 Timothy, we're told there's one mediator between man and God, Jesus Christ. It seems like the male goat represents Jesus. And if the rest of these being burnt offerings, that'd be us. You know, we're the burnt offerings. Romans chapter 12 talks about us being a living sacrifice. What does that mean, a living sacrifice? Romans 12, 1 through 2. What's a living sacrifice? You could say, well, hey, it's an offering that's still alive. Okay, great. What does that mean, Nick?
I mean, the way that we're living our lives should be that it's a sacrifice for God.
Yeah. It's not the bull that God's so concerned about. It's not the lambs that are without blemish He's so concerned about. This is really a teaching moment. God is providing the people with a lesson that's meant to represent the way that they're living. Yes. Yeah, and we shouldn't, again, we made this point through studying the old law, we shouldn't see this and say, I'm so glad we don't have to do this anymore. We should see this and say, wow, look at what Jesus has done that these sacrifices couldn't accomplish.
And thinking about, like, the status of the animals that they were sacrificing, they needed to be without blemish.
Right.
And if we're supposed to be the living sacrifice, like, how are we presenting ourselves to God?
Right. Right.
Like what we should be working towards. Like,
yeah.
They put in a lot of work to worship God and keep these sacrifices. We need to be putting in that work on ourselves.
Right, right. And then we recognize that without blemish doesn't mean my hair's combed and put in place and I don't have any, you know, acne or things like that. But it's spiritually. So the only way I can be without blemish, living a holy life, is if I've been forgiven of my sin. I need the offering that Jesus provides. Amos?
Earlier, I'm even medicated.
Davidic atonement sacrifices are a more complex picture of what Jesus does for us, as he makes a way into the holy place for us with God. And then he also takes our sins away, takes God's people's sins away. So again. Right. Yeah, the goat that got away didn't really get away, right? But he's sent away from all the protection that he had back in the camp. Someone pointed out to me the trouble with living sacrifices, they tend to want to crawl off the altar. Julius Caesar talked about not wanting men who would die for him, but wanting men who would live. Wanting men who would fight to live. It is one thing to say, well, Jesus, I'll go wherever you want to go. And Jesus says, look, do you know how hard this is going to be? Foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, I have nowhere to lay my head. Now come on. He's not trying to discourage them, but he's like, this is reality. A living sacrifice, where I'm giving my all to God. Okay, that gets us through chapter 29. Questions or comments before we move into 30, 31, and 32? All right, chapter 30 is going to be about vows. 31... we're looking at Midian and the way that, remember the women from Moab and Midian came down and enticed the men and enticed the nation to worship Baal at Peor. And in 32, we'll look at these tribes here. I've got about 5 minutes to do this, so I'll try. In chapter 30, let's look at verse 1 through 5. Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes, the people of Israel, saying, this is what the Lord has commanded. If a man vows a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his vow. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. If a woman vows a vow to the Lord and binds herself by a pledge, while within her father's house in her youth, and her father hears of her vow and of her pledge by which she has bound herself and says nothing to her, then all her vows shall stand, and every pledge by which she's bound herself shall stand. But if her father opposes her on the day that he hears of it, no vow of hers, no pledge by which she has bound herself shall stand, and the Lord will forgive her because her father opposed her. All right. So if a man, now we're looking at a man who's old enough to be head of his own household, essentially. So this is not children. But a man who takes a vow, if he vows a vow before the Lord, what happens? He's got to keep it. Psalm 15 talks about those who would dwell in God's holy place. And one of them is one who would swear to his own hurt and not change. So I'm going to agree to do this thing. I'm going to promise to do this thing. And then later I find out, oh, it's going to cost me this. I don't know about that. You swear to your own hurt, and you don't change. You keep that promise. Kind of like, yeah, I'll go help you move on Saturday, and then later I find out Saturday, yeah, but my buddy's going to go and watch this movie. I don't know about that. But you can't renege on helping your buddy move just because it's going to hurt you. You got to go and do the thing you said you're going to do. And so in keeping a promise to the Lord, you keep that vow. That's the kind of people God wants his people to be. Now, if it's a daughter, she's living in the house with her father, and she vows a vow, and her father hears it, he's got an option. He can negate that vow, or he can just stand back and say nothing. If he negates the vow, she doesn't keep the vow. If he stands back and says nothing, he doesn't even have to say, yes, daughter, she can keep, like, he just says nothing, and the vow stands. What's the point being made here, do you think?
It's showing who has authority in that household, that the father has authority to say, like,
yeah. And so he's responsible for her welfare. So he's in a position of protecting her and keeping her from making a vow that would be to her detriment. That's really what this is about. It's not about denying her the privilege of making a vow, but it's about protecting her and keeping her best interests in mind. Right? Same thing with a married couple. What we're going to see in verse 6 is if she marries a husband while under her vows or any thoughtless utterance of her lips by which she's bound herself, and her husband hears of it and says nothing to her on the day that he hears, then her vows shall stand and her pledges by which she has bound herself shall stand. But if on the day that her husband comes to hear of it, he opposes her, then he makes void her vow that was on her and the thoughtless utterance of her lips by which she bound herself, and the Lord will forgive her. But any vow of a widow or a divorced woman, anything by which she has bound herself, shall stand against her. So she doesn't have that protection there. So you've got this system set up where there's an authority. And you see what the authority is there for. The authority is meant to protect those who are under authority. Leadership is meant to be a service. It's not to be domineering. It's meant to be a service to others. Now, if the husband or the father says nothing on the day the vow was taken, but then later they try to get in the way of them keeping the vow, well, who's in trouble? The authority's in trouble. The husband or the dad's in trouble. So responsibility, you've got to step up and do that in the right way. The woman that will be forgiven, but the husband or the father would not be. He shall bear the iniquity. Verse 15, if he makes them null and void after he has heard of them, then he shall bear her iniquity. All right, so vows are important. They're accepted by God, old covenant, new covenant, taking these oaths in this way to give an offering to God. It's acceptable, but it has to be done in a proper way, and God expects people to keep it. Alex? Good question. Why does it say anything about the vows of a son? That's probably my favorite answer. So, anybody have any thoughts about that? Yeah, I assume he's young enough. He's not vowing property of his own until he's older and head of his own household. But beyond that, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to it. Justin, did you have a hand? No. All right. Elijah?
So, at the end of verse 15, what does it mean to prepare for her? Does that mean, he's going to keep the oath instead of her?
No, he got in the way of her making an oath. He got in the way of her fulfilling her vow. So God will forgive her, but he'll hold him accountable. So he's going to be guilty for what she should have done. Right? I really wanted to get into chapter 32 today because there's some really powerful points in Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh. We're just going to have to wait on that. It's about 10 till, so we'll spend the next 10 minutes getting ready for worship. I appreciate your discussion. Go ahead and read through the end of Numbers if you want to for next time. But really appreciate the discussion, everybody, and we'll get ready for worship. Thank you.